Broadcasting from the studios of Business Radio X, it's time for Litigators Lounge. This show is brought to you by Hall Booth Smith, guiding clients through challenging workplace legal issues. Now, here are your hosts.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Litigators Lounge. It's your go-to source for insightful discussions on workplace dynamics and legal issues and all things workplace related. I'm Jackie Voronov, and I'm here with my sensational co-host, Shiley Bannon. How are you today, Shiley?
I'm good. How are you, Jackie?
I'm very good. Happy Monday. This is the best way to kickstart a new work week is getting to chat with you.
Yes. And since we're recording early today, I have a mimosa instead of a lychee martini. I'm trying to stay appropriate, but perhaps it should be a Bloody Mary instead.
You're getting it started. You do you, girl. I'm proud of you.
I'm really excited today, Jackie, because we've closed out Women's History Month, and now we're moving into our next series about immigration law. And whenever I think about immigration law, all I can think about is the line from Hamilton, immigrants, we get the job done.
And, do you think about immigration law?
I'm sorry?
I said, do you do a lot of thinking about immigration law?
Not a whole lot, but I think that everybody has had immigration on their minds lately without getting too political. It's certainly a buzzword that's heard if you happen to walk past any television that has the news on. So since I don't do immigration law, and I know you don't practice immigration law.
I definitely don't.
No, but I know it is something that is personal to both of us, as you are, in fact, an immigrant to this country yourself, and I am first generation. I felt like bringing in an expert on this kind of topic and in this subject matter would be really important. So we have invited Misty Borkowski, one of our partners from our Little Rock, Arkansas office, to join us. How are you, Misty?
I am doing very well. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, we're very excited. Jackie and I are not super familiar with all the technicalities of immigration law. And if there's one thing that I do know is that there are a lot of technicalities, which I think is true with any federal bureaucracy. So we are so glad that you're here to talk to us about some of the big issues in employment law, focusing on immigration law, that our listeners might need to know about. So over the next couple of series of episodes, we're going to be talking about some different issues. But today, Misty, what is our topic today? What are we talking about?
So you are absolutely correct that immigration law is, we are dealing with laws, the statutes, but we're also dealing with regulations and public policy and foreign affairs manuals, all kinds of things that go into controlling how a foreign national can live in the U.S., they can come into the U.S. to work, to study, and there are different avenues. When I am talking to new clients that have never dealt with immigration, I describe the globe that your children may have as toddlers. And this globe has the circle, it has the square, it has the star, it has the triangle. And you've got to fit those shapes into the correct shape. And that's exactly how immigration is. So you've got, for each category, we use letters, and those letters derive from the statute. So we use letters to describe the type of visa it is and how someone goes from one visa to the next, or how someone comes into the U.S. and gets on one of those visas. So starting off, I thought, for especially because we represent a lot of employers, I wanted to talk about the very basic trajectory that an employer is going to see when someone has come into the U.S. and they are wanting to become employed. And so that's where I thought we would start with this episode. Does that sound good?
That sounds great to me. Yeah. But before we do that, and I know we're going to talk about all these different letters, and the only ones that I really think about are from my pop culture consumption of 90 Day Fiancé, which I think is for a different episode, maybe on a different podcast.
Completely.
Tell me a little bit about how you got into immigration law, because this is such a technical and specialized area of law, and you're from Little Rock. I know that you're a fluent Spanish speaker. How did you end up becoming this immigration maven?
I had started my career in government. And so at some point we had a growing our family, and I took a hiatus, a very short hiatus, because I realized that mom's happiness was truly in the workplace. I had better skills there than I did at home. So when I was looking what was my next career path in law, I was part of the Little Rock Sister Cities Commission. And at that time, Little Rock was the Mexican government was opening a U.S. consulate in Little Rock. And so we were very closely connected to the government or to the consulate opening here. And they wanted to have a local attorney that they felt comfortable with, they could trust, they could rely on. And I started building my private practice based on that relationship. And it just stemmed from that, but it has definitely grown in the direction of immigration practice to the point where I'm pretty much 100% immigration.
Okay.
Misty, who are your primary clients? Is it on the corporate side? Is it your mom and pop employer looking to hire outside? Is it employees?
Often employees may be the first one to reach out to us, but if they are with an employer and that employer is going to be sponsoring, we want the employer to be involved immediately because it's employment-based sponsorship in the majority of the cases. It runs the gamut. I represent multinational companies. I represent small companies. It runs the whole spectrum, quite frankly. And the beauty of immigration law, and this is one of the things that I love so much, is I get to represent companies and employers no matter where they are. Because it's a federal practice, I'm not limited to a state license. Obviously, I'm licensed in Arkansas, but with immigration, I have clients all over the country. And that I really do enjoy.
That's awesome. See, with me, I can fit all of my knowledge about immigration law on the tip of a pen. So having you here today is really helpful. I hear a lot of buzzwords. I'll hear H-2A visa, H-2B visa, H-whatever visa. And I don't know. And I'm not too humble to admit I don't know what that is.
And Jackie, to be fair, when my clients start getting into employment law questions, I'm like, I'm sorry, you've gone outside the scope of what I have knowledge on. Let me send you down the hall to Jackie, to Shiley, to Abton. So other people will handle those questions.
All right. Well, so why don't you start where most of our listeners are going to be interested is when they are considering opening a position or hiring for a position for a foreign national. And I think today we're going to focus on folks who are mostly coming out of school and in sort of white collar professional roles. Where do you typically get involved and what do employers need to start thinking about when they have somebody who is currently in the United States on a, let's say, a student visa or some other type of visa that doesn't necessarily render them eligible to work right away? What do we look at?
And that's going to be typically where the employer becomes acquainted with the foreign national for the first time is when someone has entered into the U.S. and they are on a student visa. Then when they complete their degree, and it could be a bachelor's degree, it could be a master's, they will be eligible for OPT employment. So that's basically occupational practical training. What that does is it's twofold. It gives the foreign national an opportunity to be employed in the U.S. for a year, and it gives an employer an opportunity to work with that foreign national, get them some employment experience. That is typically where that relationship is going to build. And what I always recognize is that the reason an employer is going to sponsor someone on a visa is they truly do need that skill or what the employee brings, but it's also the relationship. So it is that relationship that will cause an employer to spend money to go through the process to sponsor someone on a visa. So that's how you're first going to get to have that relationship.
So if I understand correctly, you have a student who's here on, you gave me some notes, an F1 student visa. So they're a student at a university on an F1 student visa typically. And automatically as part of the F1 student visa, they have the opportunity to work for 1 year post-graduation.
Correct. Yep.
And so that 1 year is like an audition period for them and a time for them to really develop that relationship with an employer, correct?
That is a good way to sum that up. Yes.
Okay.
And so, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so what happens next?
So in some of these cases, if the foreign national has studied in a STEM subject, so science, technology, engineering, mathematics, if it is a certain code, and there is a list of codes that are eligible for STEM extensions, then that student can extend for an additional 2-year period. Instead of that 1-year relationship, the employer may be getting a 3-year relationship with that student. So that is, again, helps to bridge that relationship and causes an employer to be willing to invest in that sponsorship.
And during that initial audition period or the OPT period, that's either 1 year or 3 years, can the employee, the visa holder, can they change employers? And if so, what does that do to the time period that they have to work on that visa?
They can change employers. It doesn't change the time period. It's going to be 1 year. It's going to be 3 years. And that is set. But they can change employers. Now, it still needs to be in their field. So whatever their subject matter is, they can't just... This is not intended to give the foreign national a platform for going and being a hostess at the local restaurant. That's not the intent. It really does need to be in the field because they have to communicate with their school. They have to talk to the DSO, the designated service office for the college or university, and keep their records clean about what they're doing.
All right. And so let's say everything is working out. This foreign national has really impressed their employer. The employer wants to keep them because we know how hard it is to find good employees that we click with, especially in certain fields. What happens next? Where do they need to go as this clock is ticking down on the OPT time? And also, when do they need to start thinking about the next step?
So this is where the employer is going to get into the decision about to go forward with H-1B sponsorship. So the H-1B visa is the visa for, it's called a specialty occupation, but what it boils down to is someone who has a college degree. And again, you have to have a job that requires a college degree, and you got to match it with the foreign national who has a college degree in that field. And so the example I give to clients is, I can't have a bank file a petition, an H-1B petition for a teller. A teller is not a position that requires a college degree. But if it's a financial analyst, then I need a foreign national who has a degree in finance. They can't have a degree in landscape architecture. So it's got to be that matching. So the timing is the real critical issue, because the majority of companies are going to be cap subject. And what that means is there is a limited number of H-1B visas that are allowed every year. And if you aren't selected in the lottery, then you have to wait until the next year. And so that's where the timing becomes very critical for these companies. For example, we just in March had the H-1B visa lottery registration period for the lottery that was pulled for this year. And not to get really into the weeds, but we're talking about a fiscal year that starts in October 1. So we're doing the lottery for a fiscal year that starts October 1 of this year. The visas that they're applying for will not take effect until October 1. But basically, there are 65,000 allotted every year. That's for the regular bachelor's degree. If someone has a U.S. master's degree, there's an additional 20,000. So that's your limitation for every employer, and every employer across the nation is competing for those numbers.
What about PhDs or MBAs? Is that all still part of that 20,000 cap?
Yeah, it is. But the thing that we always have to remind employers and the foreign national is it has to be a U.S. So
U.S.
you're not,
granting institution.
Right. Not for the bachelor's degree. We can file a lottery for anyone who has a U.S. bachelor's degree or an equivalent. So you can have equivalency evaluations that will show that their college degree in their country is the equivalent of a U.S. degree, and that allows them to also qualify.
This may be a little bit of a jaded question. Is the lottery truly a lottery?
Oh, yeah.
It's very random.
In fact, the 3 years ago, the government, with the technology, we now do the registration online. Previously, we were taking someone who wanted to submit a petition and we had to complete the entire petition. We had to send in the filing fees, signature pages, the entire packet. And that was what was part of the selection. So now it's automated. We go in and we fill in a very little information about the company, information about the foreign national, pay $10 and it gets submitted. And then it's an electronic lottery. So it's been, with this change, it really has been, I rarely compliment the government, but this has been such a, my life in April used to be absolutely miserable leading up to April because we had to get everything done. And now it's a matter of getting on the call with the client for 30 minutes, completing the registration, and we're good to go. So it's made it very accessible.
What is the number of applicants average that we've seen in the last few years for these capped H-1B visa lottery spots?
So the one interesting thing about the H-1B lottery registration is it tracks the economy. So when we have a robust economy, we are going to have roughly around 440,000 registrations. 2023 was an anomaly because we had, I think, in the 700,000 registration, but there was fraud. So that was a complete anomaly. The government has shut that down, hopefully to some extent, but you're typically going to see about 1 in 4 odds of being selected. So that, but again, back to the point about it tracking the economy, in 2008, 2009, when we were really having a struggling economy, we had visas that were still available up into the summer. It's just, that's how it works, is when companies are competing for employees, there are more of these that are going to be filed.
I started practicing law in 2009, so I remember those dark days well.
You piqued my interest. I heard words like fraud thrown in there, and now I want to know the tea. What happened in 2023?
So in 2023, it's always been that as the foreign national can have multiple registrations submitted, right? So you could have company A sponsor them, company B sponsor them, company C sponsor them. That was entirely possible. And there was no issue with that. What happened in 23 is it became well known that in countries that are very competitive for these spots, for example, in India, there were entities that were creating shell entities. And so they would sponsor them or submit them for the registration, because remember, it's been costing $10 for this registration. And so they were submitting multiple shell companies for individuals, and the individuals, which this is not allowed either, the individuals would pay for these shell companies to do the registration.
And it's only $10.
And it was only $10. Now it's going up next year to $215, but still, that when they ran the numbers, like there was one individual who had, most of them would have, let's say, 10 to 13 registrations submitted for the foreign national. There was one that I think had 99. So it was just off the charts what was going on, and it completely skewed everything. And then when you're looking at the small employer, who this is their one shot to get somebody that they've been maybe submitting for 3 years, it really has been a hardship on employers for this fraud to go on. And the government caught it quickly, and they have, what they did is they stopped allowing multiple registrations for foreign national. Now they're limited to one.
So there are some employers, though, that do not have to go through this lottery or don't have the cap, correct?
Yes. So those are cap exempt employers. And the benefit to them is they can file as many H-1B petitions as they want at any point in the year. They are not subject to any quota, any limitation. And so when you're talking about a cap exempt employer, you're really looking at typically, probably the biggest is going to be your colleges or universities. So those qualify as institutions of higher education. And then you can have other nonprofits that have an affiliation agreement with those. Public schools often will have an affiliation agreement with a college or university. And you think about that in this, in from the perspective of, for example, a public school gives someone in an education degree an opportunity to student teach, basically. And so those are set up. That doesn't just randomly happen. Those are often set up because they have a formalized affiliation agreement. And that agreement gives the public school the opportunity to be Cathy's. And so it's, I don't think a lot of schools use this. Often they would be their, like their state education department, maybe a J-1 sponsor. I know we're in Arkansas, and I think up until maybe 2010, our public school system, the state school system, Department of Education, was a J-1 sponsor. And so they could get teachers on the J-1 visa. But that, but for Arkansas, they have stopped doing that. But schools can still be CAP exempt.
That's very interesting, because one of the cases that I remember from my first year constitutional law class was actually a case about a public school teacher and how the job requirement was that they were a United States citizen to be a public school teacher, and that was upheld to be constitutional. So that's, it's very interesting. That would be an area where sponsorship would be allowed in public education.
And two, if you think about some of the articles that have come out about schools having a really hard time in getting teachers into those spots, it really does open up some options, because you have individuals who are often extremely highly educated. So PhDs, masters, and they would love an opportunity to work in the U.S. as long as they can go through the process to get, for example, even a provisional license. So let's say they didn't study here. They go through the process to get a provisional license that will allow them to apply for the H-1B. And then that gives them the opportunity to get a permanent license in the U.S., teaching license.
Now, let's assume you get one of these H-1Bs for your employee. And first of all, this is a cost that's usually borne by the employer, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Are there times where the employer will then charge it back to the employee? Is that allowed? What's the typical agreement?
So the regulations require that some of the specific fees are an employer responsibility, and they cannot be charged back. So we discourage employers from trying to collect or charge back that to the employee. In most situations, they don't. That is something they understand is an employer expense, and they move on. It's rare that you'll have a situation where the employee is actually going to bear the expense. I've had historically, it'd be the foreign national is responsible for the attorney fees, but then you have to get into a calculation about the prevailing wage. Is the employee being paid at least that much over the prevailing wage that would allow them to pay the attorney fees? And that's, you know, and that's the point where most employers are just like, this is something we're going to bear.
Let's clarify the term prevailing wage versus minimum wage, because they're two different things.
Yes, that is a very good point, Jackie. So we have to look, when we're talking about H-1B visas and the prevailing wage, what we do is we go into the FLC Data Center. This is a Department of Labor website, and you have to look at the state and then the county where the job is being held, where the work is going to be conducted. And this includes remote work sites. Remote work site has completely not changed things dramatically, but we have to be aware of that, because you could have a company in Arkansas and the foreign national works in Georgia, and the prevailing wage is going to be completely different there. But basically, based on the work site location and the job, the code and category, that is going to tell us how much the employee needs to be made based on different wage levels. So you look at wage level one, that's typically your entry level. And that's obviously going to be very much lower than somebody in wage level two with more experience. Wage level three, you might have more education as you go up the scale to having more education or more experience.
So if an employee misses the H-1B lottery, if they don't get, or an employer doesn't get that slot for an employee, you said that there are some places where they've tried 2 or 3 years. How is that employee staying and continuing to work?
There are times that an employee runs out of options, and that's a cold, hard truth to the system and how it's set up. But basically, often some of their options are going to be to go back to school. Let's say they were going through the lottery on a bachelor's degree, and they decide the next step for them is to go to for a master's degree. But I've had situations where somebody's gone all the way through to a PhD, and they still haven't been selected. They start running out of options. Yeah. Yes. And collecting debt. So it can be very brutal. If you have someone that has gone all the way to a PhD, it could be that they need someone to go through the analysis for an O visa, which is someone who's outstanding in their field. You might have them try for a national interest waiver, which is a pathway to lawful permanent residency. So there can be different options, but that is a whole different level of analysis than they compare to what an employer is looking at for an H-1B.
How long can an employee stay on an H-1B visa?
So they're limited to 6 years. And this is once someone gets on an H-1B visa, typically, again, what you're looking at is the relationship. So you have them working with an employer for a handful of years, if they haven't already had a period of time. And then everyone wants to start talking about the next step. How do we deal with the 6-year limitation? And that's where you're going to be looking at the lawful permanent residency, the sponsorship for someone to go ahead and become a lawful permanent resident. And you can't wait until the last year to make that decision, because that process in and of itself takes so long that we have to have, usually right now, it's taking a solid 2.5 years just to get to the point of having a petition filed. And that doesn't even get into the dilemma about whether or not the individual is eligible to adjust status to actually become a lawful permanent resident, because that's a two-part process going on at that point. So 6 years is the limit, unless they have an approved I-140 or their perm is filed 365 days prior to the expiration.
And the goal ultimately is lawful permanent residency?
I mean, for most foreign nationals, that I guess I can't speak for all of them, but when they come to me, that's what the goal is, for them to become a lawful permanent resident. And they're doing that because they don't have another avenue. So some foreign nationals are going to have a family-based case. So they've married someone who is a U.S. citizen, and they're just going to go through that process. You know, we've had instances where someone wants to do the permanent residency, and we're looking at the situation, you're married to a U.S. citizen, why would you not go through the family-based case? It's so much faster. It's so much easier. I would rather do that a million times than all of the, you know, jumping through all of the hoops for the lawful permanent residency process, because it is a bear.
If an employee is on an H-1B visa and they want to switch jobs, they want to switch employers, what is the process? Who's the sponsor? Does the sponsorship have to change? Do they have to start all over again?
That is an excellent question, and that's called portability. So an H-1B employee, they can go to another sponsor, they can go to another employer, and basically what happens at that point is that employer has to go through not the registration. They never have to go through the registration again during that 6-year period, but that employer does have to file their own H-1B petition. So the H-1B visa is employer specific. You have to maintain your job with that employer. You can move, but you have to have another petition filed for you.
Are you aware of any statistics? And this is just me thinking out loud. I hate to put you on the spot if there aren't, but are there
some? I love statistics. There's two things I know about Shiley Bannon. One of them is she loves statistics.
I started to pull up some data for her because I know from your other podcast, she loves statistics, but I was like, I don't know that I want to be burdened with that.
So I'm just curious, for example, during the pandemic from 2021 to 2023, we saw a blazing hot lateral market in educated and specialized job sectors, high tech, finance, legal. People are not staying in their jobs. Everybody is moving during this time period. And so I was wondering if there are any statistics that show the portability or the percentage rate of H-1B visa holders that lateraled during that time frame as compared to other kinds of employees in the United States in those same sectors. Was there less moving around? Did they have the same opportunities to take advantage of that hot lateral job market as others?
I don't have any statistics for you. I'm sorry to disappoint, but they definitely could take advantage of that. There's nothing that kept them. They weren't at a disadvantage. As long as the employer was willing to do the sponsorship, then there was no disadvantage for the foreign national having that same opportunity. I will say, to your point about COVID, one of the things that we had to deal with was people going remote. And I'm not talking about just, hey, we're shutting down the office and then 3 months later we've opened back up and everybody comes back in. We more had to deal with it where people went remote, but then didn't stay in the same MSA. So you have people who maybe a spouse got a job somewhere else. And so because the foreign national could also work remotely, they were moving. And where that comes into play is anytime an employer has a material change on an H-1B visa, then we have to file an amended petition. And so when you have someone who has gone to a different remote work site in a different, completely different state, different county, that becomes a material change that we have to deal with. That was one of the big factors that we saw come out of COVID is working remotely then and continuing to work remotely.
Does the nationality of the foreign national matter at all in terms of applying for H-1B visas? Is every nationality eligible?
So on the H-1B visa, the nationality does not matter. Where it starts mattering is in the PERM process, in the lawful permanent residency employment-based sponsorship. So the reason that matters, and again, not to get too far off subject there, but the reason it matters is because you have each country has a quota on how many lawful permanent residents they can be granted in a per year basis. And so you have countries, mainland China, India, Mexico, and the Philippines. These four countries have an unusually high number of people wanting to become lawful permanent residents. And so you start getting a backlog. And just by way of example, someone with a master's degree can actually, from China, they've been waiting since 2012. They have a priority date. They may have started the process in 2012, and 12 years later, they're still waiting. They haven't yet, or they're just now able to become a lawful permanent resident. So that's where the nationality plays a big role.
Misty, I think that all you have done today, other than educate our listeners, is really whet my appetite for learning more about immigration law. I'm a perpetual student beyond statistics and beyond social media food websites, which I think is the other thing that Jackie was alluding to knowing about me. I really just love learning about these new areas of law. And I think that what we see when we learn just a little bit more about immigration and you talking, for example, about foreign nationals being able to get jobs in universities and public universities. Gosh, this is such a timely topic that I think has probably always been in the news. And maybe there are discussions of this in current events and in politics about education and funding in education and obviously the border and border security and national security, et cetera. But this is such an important part of our economy and such an important part of our workplace and candidly the American culture that I think that for people having a little bit more information about how people come to the United States and how they work here, I think that it's just so helpful to know because it's going to affect so many different other areas of workplace law it's going to affect so many areas of American life.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed talking about it. I love talking about immigration.
So
that's good to know.
Yes. So we will get to talk to you some more and give our listeners some more information on different immigration topics, including agricultural workers, which I know is, I'm in Florida. It's a very big deal here in Florida. You're in Arkansas. It's a very big deal in Arkansas. New Jersey, I don't know about New Jersey.
New Jersey has some pretty decent, there's a lot of farms in New Jersey. Our tomatoes and our corn are, we're notorious for that. Among other things we're notorious for. But I don't think that's a podcast on immigration necessarily. That could be something entirely different.
Financial services sectors.
Yeah, exactly.
So thank you, Misty, for today. And we look forward to hearing more from you next time. To all of our listeners, if you have any questions on immigration issues or workplace law that you'd like to hear answered by either Misty or Jackie or me, you can send us an email at litigatorslounge@hallboothsmith.com. Thank you very much for tuning in. And until next week, cheers.
Thank you for joining us on Litigators Lounge. This show is brought to you by Hall Booth Smith, helping clients navigate the complexities of workplace legal issues. For more information, go to hallboothsmith.com.
Litigators Lounge is a production brought to you by Hall Booth Smith. This podcast is published for the purposes of providing general information and education on topics which include those related to the law and legal issues. But the contents of this podcast do not constitute legal advice. Listening to this podcast or utilizing the information contained in it in any way does not constitute, nor does it create, an attorney-client relationship between you and Hall Booth Smith or its lawyers. The contents of this podcast should not be used as a substitute for competent legal advice from a professional attorney licensed in your jurisdiction.